Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
The regular session of the 2014 General Assembly is over, but the work of lawmakers is not. I'm May Lily Lead. Thanks for joining us today. This year's 60-day session adjourned March 8th. But legislators will convene in Richmond March 24th to come up with a budget and settle the debate over Medicaid expansion. Today, we'll take a closer look at what lawmakers accomplished in those first 60 days and a look at the hurdles still ahead. Our guests are two journalists who have been covering the General Assembly for many years. Joining us in our Richmond studio, Shellyann Davis, assistant editorial page editor for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, and from the studios of WVTF in Roanoke, Mike Sluss, political reporter with the Roanoke Times. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks.
Good morning.
Hi there, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Let's start off, if we can, Shellyann, with just an overview. Here we have a new governor for the first time working with the General Assembly. And McAuliffe is not only new to the lawmakers, but new to the state. I mean, this is a gentleman who has to work his way in. He doesn't have these longstanding relationships with people already at the state capitol. And one of the things he did to help initiate that connection with lawmakers was to launch his 60 parties in 60 days effort at the mansion.
Exactly, yeah. The Washington Post reported on that, how he was having cocktail parties every night for various groups of lawmakers. And I, that's a way to build relationships and build friendships when he didn't have that because this is his first elected office.
As long as it wasn't Jägermeister.
That's a matter of personal opinion, probably, but, you know, if it's very cold. So he's been trying to schmooze them, and, you know, they will tell you that he has actually been pretty hands-off. They had complained about that. The Republicans, especially during session, had said they didn't hear a lot from McAuliffe about legislation. They didn't hear a lot from his staff. They were used to governors who are much more hands-on about what they want passed and what they want killed during session.
Okay, so he's making attempts through social engagements, but yet he is deemed not as involved. And why would that be?
Well, that may be a function of his personality. I think you could certainly look at his career and guess that he was going to be more more social and more used to building relationships and things over social functions rather than, sitting in legislative offices, going over bills.
Let's also talk about the balance of power both on the House side and on the Senate side. Now, there were two special elections that allowed Democrats to seize control of the evenly split Senate. And it didn't hurt that Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam is a Democrat who presides over the Senate and decides most of the tie votes. Also, Democrats took control of crucial committees, and with that, the power to decide which bills live or die.
Right. Things have been very finely balanced in the Senate since, I think it was the 2011 Senate elections. And in that election, there were 20 Republicans and 20 Democrats. And Bill Bowling, at the time, was lieutenant governor. He was a Republican. He voted with Republicans to take control. There was a lot of bitterness and a lot of recriminations at that time. This year, because Mark Herring and Ralph Northam, who were both Democratic senators, because they won the attorney general and lieutenant governor's races, respectively, that opened two Senate seats for special elections. Those elections happened during the session. So we began session with Republicans in control. And, you know, a little bit before halfway through, Democrats won those two special seats. Because Ralph Northam, a Democrat, is now lieutenant governor, the Democrats did exactly what Republicans had done to them and voted to change the rules and seize the control of the Senate and committees. And so, again, there's bitterness and recrimination.
Gotcha. So while one might say, oh, well, look, here's a majority Democratic Senate, they'll be able to work closely with the Democratic governor. Actually, what we're looking at is the opening for backlash.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 20 vote, being tied in the Senate and having only Northam as your majority vote is not that big of a majority. And especially when it comes to budget issues, which is the big thing holding things up now, is that the lieutenant governor cannot vote on the budget. So Democrats have to get help from the Republican side for things like this Medicaid expansion, which they had three Republicans who are voting with them at the moment, but, you know, who knows what's going to happen down the road.
Now, what about the House? Let's take a look at that and the makeup on the House side.
The House is a strongly Republican majority, 60-some. I can't remember the exact numbers because they had a special election as well. So I believe they have a veto-proof majority. So the House can do what it wants in terms of Republican priorities, and they do. And when it comes, again, to the Medicaid and budget battle, you know, they have the numbers that they don't have to do a lot of negotiating if they don't want to. They feel very strongly in the House Republican caucus against Medicaid expansion. And, you know, that plus the Democrats in the Senate, their position for Medicaid expansion, that is why we are at a budget impasse.
And we're going to talk about Medicaid expansion down the road here in the program. First, I want to do an audio check. Mike, can you hear us and can we hear you? Hello?
I think you've got me by telephone now.
Hello. Great to hear you. Mike, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. And you were able to hear our conversation so far, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So one of the things that fascinates me about the start of the 60-day session and the 60-day session itself is as much as the governor has tried to make inroads to connect with lawmakers, there have just been impasse after impasse. Certainly some successes. However, you look at some of the smaller things that have happened and what they mean symbolically. For instance, the customary visit to the governor's Capitol office after the session is declared done. Normally, House Republican leaders go over and visit and say goodbye. That did not happen this year. What is going on? These can't be ignored.
Well, I think there's still a feeling out process going on with everyone. Keep in mind, McAuliffe was completely an outsider to state government, unlike the last two governors who had held statewide office before moving into the mansion. So I think despite the schmoozing that's going on after hours, there's still relationships being built. I don't know that I would read too much into that at this point.
How about this one? Do you remember the self-appointed House Sensitivity Caucus? There's usually a sort of a satire that goes on at end of session with awards to lawmakers. There was nothing like that this year.
Well,
don't,
I could
don't read into
because,
that either.
Well, perhaps the optics of that would not have been very good when their most important job is still unfinished, and that's passing a budget. It could be that appearing to be goofing off in the final days of a session
I can't
when
hear
you've not completed your most
but
basic
I agree with
task.
Him. The Sensitivity Caucus didn't have anything to do with McAuliffe. You know, it's sort of a running joke amongst the House guys who sit in the back of the row and, you know, make jokes. But I think Mike is right. They haven't got a budget. They're fighting about Medicaid expansion, which is this huge important issue. And I think they probably thought it would look bad to be sitting in the back of the room cracking jokes on the last day of session.
Yeah. All right. You've set the stage for us to discuss this. As we know, when McAuliffe ran for office, he made that a cornerstone. He wanted Medicaid expansion in Virginia. Republicans, for the most part, did not. Democrats saw it as a financial boon to Virginia. Republicans saw it as a liability. And so now we're in gridlock on this. A little background on why it has become such a lightning rod.
Well, you know, you could see this coming from months away. And so the Medicaid expansion is part of the Affordable Care Act, which Republicans call Obamacare, and have increasingly been calling Obamacare as it ties in with this Medicaid expansion because they feel the entire thing is this big boondoggle. It's a horrible idea. And they feel that it's going to cost Virginia money if we expand Medicaid to cover more people because they do not believe the federal government's promises that it will pay for the bulk of this in perpetuity. So those are just some of their many arguments against it. On the Democratic side, they're pointing out that Virginia's federal tax dollars are going to Medicaid or would be coming back to us for Medicaid expansion if we had expanded, and that therefore we're just giving up money that we could be using to cover poor people and alleviate pressure on hospitals, which have to cover a lot of indigent care anyway. So those are some of the arguments that are, I guess, going on about that.
I want to read this quote from the Washington Post about this. McAuliffe called on the House and Senate to return to the Capitol in 2 weeks. That's going to be at the end of March to continue work on a two-year, $96 billion budget to fund schools, universities, local governments, and other state services. But there was little optimism that the special session would lead to a quick resolution of the budget stalemate, which turns on whether to expand Medicaid under the federal health care law, everyone knows informally as Obamacare. As McAuliffe and a bipartisan majority in the Senate are bent on expansion and the GOP-dominated House remains staunchly opposed, legislators were bracing for a drawn-out showdown, one that could threaten state services if it is not resolved by July 1st, which is the start of the new fiscal year. And in other articles, I read that we could be shuttered. Could it be this devastating to state government?
Well, if they don't, if one side does not blink before the end of June, and we have been here before, in 04 and 06, major policy issues were put into the budget by one side, I think actually both by the Senate, and we had a protracted budget impasse because, you know, the House did not want to do, in 06 it was transportation, in 04 it was tax reform, and at least one of those years, I mean, both years got up into spring. And the problem with this is the longer you go, the more it affects local governments because they need to start writing their own local budgets, you know, along about April, May, and they need to know how much state money they have. And so if you really get into June, you're really getting towards a problem. We have never reached July 1st, which is when the next state budget takes effect, without a budget. But we have come fairly close. I'm pretty sure one of those years we were in June. And so McAuliffe and the Senate Democrats have put this issue into the budget to force the House to negotiate because they assume, and I think they're probably right, that if it were a standalone bill, the House would simply kill it and say, well, you know, now we're done because we've killed this bill. The House has taken the tack in the past week or two of lobbying the public to pressure the Democrats to decouple Medicaid from the budget because they say, and they're probably right, that it's not that far apart. If you look at, you know, the rest of the budget, the House and the Senate versions are pretty close. They could be done with the budget in a few days if it were not for Medicaid expansion. So really what you're looking at is just who is going to, you know, who's going to blink first. And for McAuliffe and the Democrats in the Senate, they think they have the moral argument on their side. They have the Chamber of Commerce on their side. They have Virginia's Hospitals and Healthcare Association on their side. So they think that they have a lot of leeway in which to pressure the Republicans to come around. House Republicans also think that they can hold out because there's really no plus for them with their base to give in. Base Republican voters do not like Obamacare. They don't like the Affordable Care Act. They don't want Medicaid expansion. And they would be really furious with their House members if they caved and voted for Medicaid expansion. Those base voters were pretty mad at a lot of them last year for voting for the transportation bill. So, you know, they're coming into this with some angry supporters over transportation last year. There's not a lot of upside for House Republicans to give in on this. So I think both sides at the moment are pretty well dug in. I have trouble envisioning where a middle ground is because it's not a matter of negotiating, you know, ways in which to do this. It's a matter of negotiating whether or not to do it.
And I'm going to add to your list among the supporters of Medicaid expansion is the mental health care community. And mental health reform is something we'll talk about later on the show as well. That's going to be a huge topic coming in a special session because there was some work done in the 60 days around mental health care reform. However, many have said there's still much more to be done. And Medicaid expansion was going to be a cornerstone of that in many ways, at least on McAuliffe's plate.
Right. It provides more money for that if you expand Medicaid. And the mental health issues had arisen, of course, because of Senator Credeed's and the tragedy with his son who was mentally ill and who shot himself and attacked last November. And so Senator Deeds had come into session with, you know, a number of things that he wanted to see changed in how Virginia handles particularly emergency situations. And he wanted extensions of emergency custody order timeframes and temporary detention order timeframes and more clarity on how one finds a open psychiatric bed for somebody who is in an emergency situation. And I think that in the end, they did get a bill that covered a lot of those things and that satisfied Senator Deeds. Mike had covered that more extensively, so if we get hold of him, he can tell you more about that. But the broader issues of funding in the long term are probably something that would be dealt more with the Medicaid expansion issue. And Senator Deeds himself had said, you know, this is only a first step. There's a lot that needs to be changed and improved in how Virginia delivers mental health services in emergency and non-emergency situations.
Yeah. Shelley, in your 14 years, as we talk about, you know, could there be a government shutdown or could things slow? In your 14 years of covering state government, have we approached this? Have you seen it? Has there, yeah, tell us what you've seen. So, I like that.
I nodded at her. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, Radio Land. Yeah, I feel like I have dealt with more budget impasses than years in which we didn't have budget impasses. And usually they're a few days or a few weeks. But those two particular ones that I noted, 04 and 06, really went for a long time. And we did have to start thinking about, you know, what happens if we get to July 1st without a budget? And there was really no agreement and no provision on what will happen. I believe during the Kaine administration, that would have been the 06 one, I believe he declared that he would have the power as governor to keep like a skeleton government running, to pay for certain things, certain critical services. But I don't think that he felt he had the power to just keep government running as it is. And I think it's certainly a situation that nobody really wants to face. And Republicans have been critical of McAuliffe for saying, you know, he's willing to go till June 1st or, you know, referring to June 31st as, or June 30th, I'm sorry, as some sort of drop dead deadline when they feel, because of local governments, because of the great catastrophe that a non-budget would be, that deadline is really a lot earlier than that. And they say, well, you know, look how inexperienced he is. He doesn't even know that we need this far before June 30th. So
yeah, so no, the answer is no, but the threat right. has been there.
Right. No, we have not been there, but the threat has definitely been there.
You know, we're used to it. We experienced a federal shutdown, so we're all primed.
But the difference is the federal shutdown, they can keep running. And we can't keep running in the exact same way that we normally run.
So the impact would be much more adverse.
I believe so, yes.
Well, that's an important and dangerous thing to be calling a bluff on.
Well.
We're talking with Shelley Ann Davis with the Fredericksburg Freelance Star. She is assistant editorial page editor. We'll get Mike Sluss in a moment, political reporter with the Roanoke Times. I want to remind you that the deadline to apply for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act is coming up. We'll help you through the process on the next Virginia Conversations. That's next week's show. But in the meantime, stay with us. We'll have more on this year's session of the General Assembly. We'll talk with Shelley Ann and Mike. And we invite you to check out our website, virginiapublicradio.org. We'll see you in just a few moments. And we're back. Today we're discussing what lawmakers have accomplished in Richmond and what lies ahead. Our guests are Shelley Ann Davis, assistant editorial page editor for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, and Mike Sluss, political reporter with the Roanoke Times. Mike, we started to touch on mental health care reform. That's big in your area. And, of course, that was precipitated by what happened to Cree Deeds with his son and the fatal shooting and the stabbing that injured Cree Deeds. You've been covering that pretty extensively. Can you tell us where are we in terms of mental health care reform now that we've seen the end of the 60-day session?
I think
Senator Deeds would say we're at a good starting point. They addressed some issues with the emergency intake system that obviously went awry in the situation with his son. They extended the duration of emergency custody orders from 6 hours to 12 hours. This gives mental health workers more time both to evaluate people coming in for psychiatric treatment, but also, more importantly, to find beds for them when they meet the conditions for temporary detention. There was a whole sequence of really tragic inefficiencies and miscommunications in the Deeds case. This omnibus bill that was passed last week should address a number of those. In addition to extending the ECO period, there are provisions that spell out that law enforcement is responsible for calling the Community Services Board as soon as an ECO is issued. The CSB has to immediately contact the nearest state hospital to say they've got a case coming in. These sorts of things were not in place unfortunately, last fall. But these only address the situations with emergency cases. There still are a whole host of other issues around mental health that need to be addressed. And so Senator Deese feels like what was just as important as this bill was the approval of a resolution that sets up a joint subcommittee that will do a four-year comprehensive study of the mental health system, addressing a whole range of issues from emergency services to the issue of mental health patients in jails, et cetera. So it was unfortunate that after the Virginia Tech shootings in 2007, mental health was really in the spotlight for that following session, 2008. About $42 million in new money was pumped into the system, but a lot of that went away, evaporated during the recession, and the issues sort of faded from everyone's consciousness. I think it's going to stay a little more in the focus now in light of what's happened in the last year.
Mike, it also seems that historically mental health has been the domain of the Democrats, but up until 2007-8. And then after that, it felt much more partisan, bipartisan. You heard, for instance, former Governor McDonnell really, really advocating for mental health care reform. Did it seem that way to you?
Yeah, I don't think there's a partisan split on this issue at all. I think the urgency is felt by people on both sides of the aisle. And interestingly, I think Chris Jones, the House Appropriations Chairman, has expressed great interest in this to make sure that as recommendations are made, funding is also there to support this. So I think there's going to be buy-in on both sides of the aisle.
Okay. Let's move on to ethics reform this year. Obviously, in the wake of what did happen to Governor McDonnell and his wife Maureen, the indictments there, a lot of focus on ethics reform. Gifts and campaign contributions, two separate things. There was really not much change in the way of campaign contributions, but there's new legislation around gifts, what legislators can accept. And now there's a cap at $250 a year. Prior to that, you could accept any amount as long as you reported anything you received over $50. So that's a start. Mike, share some more changes around ethics reform.
Well, I think the changes are not going to be as dramatic as what some people had anticipated. What's defined as a gift is maybe not what you and I would consider a gift. The legislature left intact a lot of perks that they currently are eligible for, things like dinners from lobbyists, tickets to football games, and this sort of thing. Those are considered intangible gifts, and there are no limits on those.
We saw lawmakers take a golf trip under the aegis of Dominion last year. So a golf trip would be an intangible, yes?
That's right.
Okay.
Travel is not limited at all. Entertainment is really not limited. These are things that the way the bill is structured are things that maintain their value after they're given to you. So a dinner, you consume it, and it has no value beyond that. But, if somebody gives you an expensive necktie or something like that, that would count toward your gift limit. So I think people are going to realize next year when these reports start getting filed and they see that the dinners are continuing, the football tickets are still being accepted, they're going to say, hey, wasn't there an ethics bill passed last year that was supposed to stop this? I think that's when we're going to realize that this bill doesn't go as far as maybe folks had been expecting when the session began.
And what is up with that? You would think, Shellyann and Mike, that with the giant microscope on this issue, I mean, it's not something that just came out of the blue or in a vacuum. It came on the heels of the McDonald's indictments. You'd think that there would have been something much greater with more teeth. Why the soft pedaling?
Well, you're asking them to regulate themselves. and the very lobbyists that they receive these gifts from are lobbying them on this bill. I think that they maybe view the McDonald's issues as something that is very unusual, which it is unusual, and far out of the scope of normal, I guess, how things normally work. And so, but I think they thought it would be very difficult and very complicated if they had to limit their dinners and limit and regulate and report a lot more things than they currently do. So, but Mike is right. I mean, this bill really does not prevent them from doing almost anything that they're already doing. You can still take a $4,000 hunting trip from, you know, Dominion or whoever was giving those to some legislators. You can still go to Augusta on a lobbyist dime if you're a legislator. You can still take all the Redskins tickets and all the wolf trap tickets, which many of the Northern Virginia lawmakers take, you know, dinners. It really doesn't touch on hardly anything because most of the gifts that legislators get are intangible.
Yeah. The ethics legislation, I will repeat, as Mike pointed out, didn't put any limits on those intangible gifts. And the list here includes, and I'll sound a little redundant here, meals, transportation and trips. And you referenced that trip by Dominion. Well, Delegate Matthew James was one of those in attendance, and he said that the legislation was a good compromise. It's an interesting quote, given that he took the trip. And he's not the only one. Many lawmakers take advantage of these trips, and that's just business as usual for the old Dominion. I suspect that other states would look at this and go, wow, this is such a carryover from the old days. It's a surprise that Virginia still gets away with as much of this courting as they do.
Mike might be able to speak to this a little bit more, but I believe that in a ranking of ethics laws and disclosure laws statewide, that Virginia ranked pretty low. Mike, do you remember that study?
Well, I think that on disclosure, I think this had more to do with disclosure than what was actually allowed and not allowed. And this ethics bill does tighten up and strengthen some disclosure requirements. So there are some advances made there. But I think what this issue really comes down to, and I think Senator Chap Peterson addressed this when the bill was on the Senate floor, is that this really should come down to a question of, are we receiving perks or advantages that are available to us just because we're legislators that aren't available to the general public? And I think if you judge the adequacy of this legislation in those terms, it really doesn't go very far.
Another measure under ethics reform relates to stocks and stocks held by lawmakers and their families. So one of the agreements was an agreement to scrap a key provision that would have blocked the kind of financial maneuvering that federal prosecutors allege Maureen McDonnell undertook to evade disclosure requirements. Originally, the proposal would have required lawmakers to report stock sales and transfers above a certain threshold, not just the ownership of stocks at a particular time. A lot of this, again, hinging on the McDonnell indictments. Reportedly, McDonnell sold and repurchased stock between December 2011 and January 2012, enabling her to avoid disclosing the stock at the time the reports were due. So again, some state legislation coming out of that as well. Let's move on to another issue relating to one of the big campaign promises of McAuliffe, and that is reform of SOLs. Now, Republicans will tell you that that's their idea, and McAuliffe owned it as his when he was campaigning. Nevertheless, let's talk about how that fleshed out over the 60-day session.
Both sides have been talking for a while about reforming the standards of learning tests that students take at various points in their public school career. The argument has been that those tests, while a good accountability measure when they were first conceived, have become sort of something where teachers wind up teaching to the test, where kids are just rotely memorizing things, they're not really learning as much, that take up an inordinate amount of time in the school year. So I think Mike could speak to what the final product might have looked like, but the proposal had been to cut out some of the tests at the lower levels, some of the things that were not, maybe so critical, like keep math and science, but I think they might have gotten rid of like a third grade history test, some things like that. So they were trying to streamline tests for the lower grades. And a package did pass, you know, and a compromise was reached.
Mike?
Yeah, the bills that got the most attention were the House and Senate bills that reduced the total number of tests that are taken between grades 3 and 8. I think there are 21 tests that students take now in that time window. The bill that passed would reduce that number to a maximum of 17. The idea being that that kids, especially in the earlier grades, are just so overwhelmed with these standardized tests that it's actually hurting rather than helping education.
And I really do want to point out that midway through the campaign, McAuliffe had said, "I want to get rid of SOLs." That was the quote. And then later it became revised, "I want to get rid of SOLs as we know them." And so that became more of a morphed version of revising SOLs rather than getting rid of them. Whether the first quote was a misquote and he didn't mean to say it is a question, but he said it.
I think he tends to make broad statements, especially in the heat of a campaign, that you know, maybe once his policy people get hold of him would be revised to be more specific.
We have a caller to the show who wants to talk about education, Jay from Caroline County. Good morning, Jay. How are you? And you're on the air.
Doing good. I believe the senators and the delegates are afraid to make a move because of ignorance on a local level. I was at a Board of Education meeting yesterday in Caroline County. And as a group of pastors, and the school is trying to raise money for the school system. And most people don't realize, even the administrator of the county, of the school board, said that the school bus drivers and custodians, all their money they make goes to health care. Most people didn't realize that. He said, "Why are you going to try to raise money for the school system? And you got it right there in Medicaid expansion to pay the insurance for the school bus drivers and the custodians. And that'd be a good way to fund the schools right there." And people just didn't know it. The pastors didn't know it. But they're afraid to make a move at the church because you got both sides. One's for Medicaid and the other's for not Medicaid. They call it Obamacare. There's a hatred there. It should not be there. It's an ignorance. And so upset about it. It's got to be done from the local level up, I believe.
Well, we appreciate your insight. Jay, thanks for calling in. Mike, I believe that we didn't have you patched in audio-wise when we were talking about a big part of the Medicaid stickler. Can you chime in about your coverage in the Roanoke area and what you're seeing? Because people really do seem split on this, and of course it's already had a tangible effect on budget negotiations.
Sure, and the governor was just in this area earlier this week. On Tuesday, he was in Christiansburg and Blacksburg visiting what was a free clinic is now a community health center in Christiansburg, and then going to Lewis Gale Montgomery Hospital. And here, as he has done throughout the state, the idea was twofold: to shine a spotlight on the people who need but can't access health care for lack of insurance, and also to underscore the impact that hospitals will absorb if this Medicaid funding is not available. So that's the governor's focus in the 2 weeks leading up to the special session. And meanwhile, the Republicans, as I think Shelley pointed out, believe they're on solid political ground opposing this because of all of the other problems associated with the Affordable Care Act.
McAuliffe wrote a letter to the General Assembly following the impasse, and he said, quote, "While we have proven that we are capable of working together for the common good on many issues, I am disappointed that politics have deadlocked budget negotiations this session and forced Virginia families to continue to wait until we can bring their money back to expand much-needed health coverage across the Commonwealth." Of course, there are holes in that Republicans will punch because a big piece of this funding mechanism for McAuliffe has long been Medicaid expansion. When you asked him about the budget during the campaign, the answer was Medicaid expansion. When you asked him about mental health, the answer was Medicaid expansion. A lot of folks argue that he relied too heavily on that coming through.
Yes, during the campaign, a lot of what he said was, well, we could pay for this, that, and the other if we had Medicaid expansion, which would, you know, provide more federal money for the program, and thus his theory was free up some state dollars. I just wanted to point out part of the Republican argument against expansion also is that it is so much money. The Medicaid program in Virginia is one of the fastest growing programs. It costs a lot and it's growing at a very fast rate of speed. And so their argument is that they need to get hold of that. They need to find a way to, as they would say, bend the cost curve, to hold down the spending before they expand it, if they ever expand it, because it's becoming an enormously expensive program.
And this is a quote from watchdog.org, an excerpt from them. Ever since the General Assembly adjourned without a budget because of the Medicaid expansion scuffle, McAuliffe has launched into full-time campaign mode at hospitals and clinics around the state, pushing the argument for bridging the health care coverage gap. Some city leaders have formally requested state leaders to expand Medicaid and cover their citizens' health care. Cities and counties, however, base some of their budget process off promised funding from the state. With the General Assembly at a budget impasse, some localities, including Loudoun County, Virginia Beach, Colonial Heights, New Kent, and Shenandoah County, are pleading with the governor to handle the Medicaid matter separately and pass a budget. And we will continue with this discussion after our break. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. This reminder that past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org and find out about upcoming topics by visiting our Facebook page for Virginia Conversations. We'll be back with more.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
And welcome back. We are talking about the 2014 session of the General Assembly here on Virginia Conversations. It's going into overtime as a special session is scheduled in a couple of weeks. Our guests are Shellyann Davis of the Fredericksburg Freelance Star and Mike Sluss of the Roanoke Times. When we started the program, Mike, we were talking about McAuliffe's introduction to not only Virginia, but to Virginia politics and getting to know the lawmakers with whom he's dealing. McAuliffe is new to elected office, new to Richmond. He spent much of the session trying to get to know people, especially those on the other side of the aisle, and especially around pushing for Medicaid expansion, which is his cornerstone. Many in the Republican camp thought that he was tireless in his outreach, and they admired the fact that he was trying to reach out. We talked about the 60 parties in 60 days, but others thought that he was more hands-off. What's your take from your reporting of not only him, but of the legislature this year?
Well, there were some Republican delegates who thought the hands-on approach went a little too far. They thought it reached the point of that they were being threatened if they didn't support Medicaid expansion or the alternative that the Senate passed. I think it's been thus far sort of an uneasy relationship, and there's still a feeling out process that's going on. I think I mentioned this earlier. McAuliffe came into the governor's mansion with no prior experience or real connection to state government as the past two governors had. So he has a learning curve, obviously an experienced policy staff that's helping him navigate that. But I think some Republicans also believe he's trying to substitute schmoozing for attention to detail. So this is still very much a getting to know you kind of process. I mean, he's been in office now just a little more than 2 months.
One of the things that he did early on was to sign an executive order which included the LGBT community in protection in state government. And then that was followed up by Attorney General Mark Herring's declaration that Virginia was on the wrong side of justice on civil rights matters when it came to its ban on gay marriage. Shellyann, let's start with that introduction by both men.
Yeah, that was what McAuliffe did was what Tim Kaine had done. And McDonnell had not done a similar declaration, although he had, you know, said that he felt, you know, you should not discriminate in state hiring. What Herring did was a bit more unusual, and that was a big sort of debate, I guess, in terms of rhetoric from especially House Republicans early in session. Herring said essentially that the state would not defend its own constitutional ban against same-sex marriage. There are a couple of cases, I believe one is in Norfolk, that in which couples are challenging that ban. And at the moment, a judge has ruled in their favor, and of course it will go to the Supreme Court eventually. So Herring had said he would not defend it. Republicans who are opposed to same-sex marriage were irate about this because it is his job, they said, as Attorney General to defend the state's laws, not simply the ones that he likes. So there was a lot of talk about that early on. And the House Republicans had passed a bill that would allow a member of the General Assembly to defend the laws that the Attorney General won't, but the Senate had killed that.
Right, and his defense was, I am not beholden to defend laws that are not constitutional.
Right, his argument was that the law was not constitutional under the federal constitution, and that was, you know, that superseded state law.
Mike, anything there before we go to our next caller?
No, other than I think that that those two examples you cited speak to the significance of these elections last fall, and it really did usher in a change as far as how our statewide officials view these issues.
Right, and the timing was interesting because they could have waited till the end of their terms, you know, as they're exiting, which Mark Warner did. He signed an executive order, but only as he was outgoing governor. These two gentlemen stepped right up, right out of the gate.
Yeah, although I would point out that Tim Kaine, I believe, signed a similar executive order right off the bat in his administration. The distinction between the two would be that McAuliffe, his added gender identity, that was not the case with the Warner and Kaine orders, as I recall.
Okay, let's go to line one. Richard from Richmond, good morning to you. You're on the air.
Thank you so much, Maylalele. We listen to you and watch you in Channel 23 in Richmond area. We love watching you. And I was on a business trip. I'm on the way through your area.
Thank you so much. Are you on a golf business trip sponsored by Dominion Virginia Power?
No, ma'am, I'm not. I'm going to work the races.
Okay. You're going to work the races.
The races. yeah, I think, not to get off on a tangent, but you would think that everybody in the Virginia General Assembly and everybody in Congress nationwide should have learned about what happened to Governor McDonald and his wife and just totally go away from all that. But I don't want to get off on a tangent. Speaking about medical costs, Medicaid, and everybody's got such a big problem with Obamacare and whatnot, and it's a very simple way to remedy this. There's many different doctors now that are in many different specializations, and if every doctor in every specialization could donate 1 hour of their time a month, you'd totally take care of the problem.
What a concept. What is your line of work, by the way, Richard? What do you do?
I have a PhD in education, and I'm trying to get a job at a college, and I operate a manufacturing company in Richmond, right outside of Richmond.
Well, that insight is really appreciated. Let me tap into your education background. Have you been following SOL reform? And
yes,
what's your
ma'am.
Opinion?
I follow everything. I stay in the news. My wife and I are news freaks, I guess you call it.
All right. Give me your elevator speech on SOLs before we let you go.
Elevator speech on what? Say again?
On SOL, standards of learning.
SOL, standards of learning?
Yeah. What do you think of standards?
Oh, wow. This has been a philosophy I've had for quite some time. You don't go into the classroom, for instance, and tell a student that's 14 years old in Algebra 1, you will learn this because you have to pass, you got to graduate, and we need our SOL money. No, well, why should I learn algebra? Well, because an algebraic equation is much like a recipe. Whether you're going to do metal alloys or whether you're going to do concrete or whether you're going to do a cake. Okay, 2 cups of flour plus 2 cups of sugar is 2y plus 2x. And you go in and you bake a cake and you show them how the cake tastes and you'll have the explicit attention of a 14-year-old if you're talking chocolate cake. And then they say, so this is why I learned. This is fun. And that's the end of the problem there.
Yep. Thank you so much, Richard. We really appreciate your call today and keep listening. Thanks so much. And let's go to Robert from Batesville. But before I do that, I want to chime in with a comment that came in from one of our listeners from Stanton. Mike stated that Medicaid is an unfunded mandate, and I really hope that Robert from Batesville will flesh out Mike's opinion on this. Good morning to you, Robert. What is your opinion on Medicaid expansion?
Well, I've been corresponding with my delegate about Medicaid expansion, and I think I'm reading a lot about different estimates as to the number of people that will be not covered, and I think in Virginia it's like 400,000. And I get the message back from Delegate Ferris that we can't afford it. This notion we can't afford it sort of befuddles me a little bit because the cost of Medicaid to our state doesn't really outweigh the cost of unpaid hospital bills that are shifted to all of us. And, I think creating a less healthy society is something we will end up paying for anyway. Bankrupt families, hospital bills not being paid, overuse of emergency rooms. These are things we pay for in higher premiums and doctor bills and even government assistance. And it seems ridiculous to me that disregarding the moral imperative to take care of the, less well off, this notion that it's going to be too expensive is just disregarding the fact that we already pay for it.
We really appreciate that insight. Thank you so much, Robert, for calling in. I will point out that Virginia isn't the only state grappling with Medicaid expansion. Maine lawmakers once again declared their positions on Medicaid expansion from the floor of the Senate. What was remarkable was that despite the fact that the bill to expand Medicaid to 70,000 low-income residents is significantly different from last year's, the arguments against it didn't really change. So, we're not in a vacuum here. This is a discussion around which states feel beholden to Obamacare or don't feel like Obamacare is a help or a hindrance. Mike, do you want to chime in as well?
Yeah, well, I thought the caller made an interesting point. It's similar to a point Senator Watkins made on the Senate floor late in the session that the individuals that would be covered under the Marketplace Virginia plan, which is his proposal really, they're still going to go get medical treatment when they're sick. But the place they're going to go is the most expensive place, which is the emergency room. And those costs are going to be borne by someone, whether it's through indigent care costs, higher insurance premiums. Those things are going to be passed on. So, his idea is that we could take this Medicaid funding from the federal government and use it to provide premium assistance to about 250,000 low-income Virginians to help them purchase private insurance. They would have some skin in the game as well. They would have to make co-payments, have work requirements, et cetera. Whether the federal government would approve a waiver for that is still a question, but that's going to be the heart of the debate going forward here later in the month when the special session gets going.
Another article here talking about other states grappling with this issue. The Medicaid expansion has taken on a political life of its own. It goes on to say, separate from Obamacare, in Michigan, the expected GOP Senate candidate has come out for the expansion. In deep red Louisiana, another person will make it a big issue when it's debated this spring. Democrats in tough red state Senate battles, Georgia, Kentucky, are standing up for the expansion. And this is all under the aegis of President Obama. And this is going to be a non-state related question, a non-Virginia question. But one of the things that Obama had to deal with relating not only to Medicaid expansion, but also with his Affordable Care Act, was to somehow explain to the public, yes, we are messing up. It has been a tricky navigation to try to get into the Affordable Care Act and learn about it and access it. And we've had issues with various and sundry aspects of the Affordable Care Act. And he apologized. So I want to ask you, this seems to me a rare occurrence in federal politics, let alone state politics, but Were you shocked when he said, "I'm sorry"? He said those two words that you so rarely hear from politicians.
I wouldn't say shocked, but there was a lot to be sorry for in the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, the website didn't work.
I'm very sorry.
You know, it's the website didn't work. There have been a number of other problems with it's just such a very big and complicated and changing program that the administration has, you know, changed deadlines and said, okay, you don't have to do this part of it for another year or that part of it. So I think a lot of people are very confused by it. And anybody who last fall was trying to actually buy insurance from the website, I mean, it did not work. It did not work for a very long time. And so that's definitely something that Republicans have used against the federal law and against Medicaid expansion, saying, you know, look how this did not work. And so why would we buy into this thing that was, you know, sort of flopping around, not working?
Mike?
Well, I think Shelley's right. This does become a Virginia question, because this is one of the key reasons why Republicans are saying we can't trust the federal government to hold up its end of the bargain on this. You've had the problem with the website. You've had the broken promise on you can keep your plan if you like it. There have been mandates on employers that have been delayed. There seem to be problems at every turn. And the Republicans in the House of Delegates are basically saying we're inviting more of this if we go along with expansion.
And Mike, when you look ahead to the specialist session that you and Shelley will be covering here in Virginia, and as lawmakers and the governor try to come up with a budget, do you feel that it seems like this is ambling along because of Medicaid expansion? Do you think that it's viable, those who say remove Medicaid expansion from the budget, take that out for now, make it a separate deal, and we'll be able to move forward with a real budget?
Yeah, well, right now it would seem that that's the only way we're going to get a budget. But look at the calendar. We're in the middle of March, and the fiscal year ends June 30th. That seems like a short period of time. But I think, as it was pointed out earlier in the program, in Tim Kaine's first year in office, he signed a two-year budget into law on June 30th, about 12 hours before it was going to take effect. So we've been down this road before. I guess I would point out, I asked McAuliffe when he was here earlier this week, do you believe you have the authority to expand by yourself if the General Assembly doesn't go along? I think I asked him two different ways. He didn't directly answer the question, saying only that he wants the General Assembly to go along with this. So I do wonder if push comes to shove, if he would sign a budget without Medicaid expansion and then pursue some avenue independently where he could work with the federal government on a waiver to do something like the Marketplace plan. That would set up another big battle with the General Assembly, but at least we would have a budget in place.
When you think about things from his lens, do you think that despite the fits and starts of this 60-day session, that he feels that it has been a success so far? Or do you think he's thinking, ugh, this is not what I hoped for. This is not the start that I want to mark the beginning of my 4 years.
I don't think he had any illusions that this was going to be easy. But I think he also feels like I would think he would consider his grade as incomplete at this point, because the big tasks are not finished. I think apart from Medicaid expansion, he really didn't have a lot on the line in this first session. So his success or failure is going to be judged largely on, one, can we get a budget passed in time not to cause havoc for local governments and school systems? And then secondly, can they make progress toward closing this health care coverage gap?
And that's all the time we have for this edition of Virginia Conversations. I want to thank our guests, Mike Sluss, political reporter for the Roanoke Times, and Shelley Davis, assistant editorial page editor for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in and listening, and your calls and comments were most appreciated. And we want to remind you that on the next edition of Virginia Conversations, meeting the health insurance deadline for the new Affordable Care Act, our panel of experts will be ready to take your questions and comments. You can check out all of our shows by going to virginiapublicradio.org, and you can go to Facebook to find out more about Virginia Conversations. We'll see you next week. Until then, I'm May Lily Lee. Have a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.